This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
All is well. It's great up here.
Fantastic. And up here, you mean the Northern California area?
Northern California. You got it.
Oh, all right. Cool.
Fine summer.
What's that?
It's a fine summer.
A fine summer?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, what's your take on why a subjective experience would have been selected for as opposed to animals simply being like machines with no subjective experience inside? More importantly, what is your take on how a subjective experience can possibly be created in the mind? How could neurons firing create a personal experience?
Well, this person is either wittingly or unwittingly asking the question of consciousness. Okay. So that's what that question is. And, so there's numerous ideas about this, and I'm not that knowledgeable about all the ideas that are bounding around philosophy on this topic. But I think that I think I can give us at least a reasonable once over as to why it is that this would have evolved and did evolve. When you get smart enough, when you get enough neurons in there, what you can start to do is you can have something called an imagination. And so we're pretty sure other animals probably don't have much in the way of imaginations, if at all. Maybe a little bit, actually, supposedly, I can't remember. I think it was a famous report by Wolfgang Kurler of a chimpanzee named Sultan, that he had in a cage and he tied a banana up high on a string. And then Sultan apparently looked around, saw a stick, and then used the stick to get to the banana. So nobody knows if this is true. I don't know what sorts of things have ever been, have ever sort of come out of anything like this, but certainly even a chimpanzee that watches its mother termite fish and then goes in and picks a blade of grass and does that same thing is displaying essentially an imagination. They're thinking, they're putting themselves into the future, changing their circumstances, and then they are doing something inconsistent with probably those kinds of images or something like that. Human beings, you know, we can't be sure, at least nobody's smart enough to quite know what's going on inside the heads of your more sophisticated animals at this point. But maybe some demonstrations will be convincing along the way. I'm not up on this sort of thing. I can tell you apparently there was some experiments done also, I believe, with chimpanzees where they had them look in the mirror, and so they got used to looking at themselves in the mirror. And then what they did, apparently when they were asleep, they put some red dye on their heads or some red paint on their heads. And so when they woke up in the morning, they looked in the mirror and they saw the red paint on their heads, and they then touched the red paint. They touched their forehead. And so this was a very interesting demonstration that they knew that was them. And they could imagine that the red paint was on their forehead. So this was showing evidence of essentially self-concept. In other words, they are aware that they're a creature and that they can see themselves in a mirror and know it's them. And so, you know, you're getting towards something that looks like human behavior and the human imagination. It's also in another demonstration, I think this was by a student of Jane Goodall's, watched I believe it was a female chimpanzee, had some fancy food of some kind, nuts or some such thing, and she had hidden them. And then when other chimps were following her down a path, she made very certain, she walked right past them and didn't look at them. So she was effectively appeared to be knowledgeable that others would have been observing her and therefore not to tip it off. So this, possible that what was going on, likely. I mean, she came back later and got them apparently. So this is, at any rate, the point here is that we definitely know that humans do all of these things. So they came from somewhere, and they came from a brain big enough to have essentially a matrix of which the individual finds themselves in. And they've got a model of the world that gets pretty complicated inside that head. And what you're going to see with that is going to be imagination. And so Richard Wrangham, I think, makes the point that this would have been selected for because you can imagine that the guy on the other side of the river is plotting against you. And you can imagine what it is that he would do to try to attack you. You can imagine that he would be thinking through where your vulnerabilities are. And he's going to be looking at your little fortress and your defenses, and he's going to be thinking through how to get through those. And so if you can be thinking through what he's thinking through, then you might be able to outwit him. And so that you can see that the imagination that could think about what another person was thinking and thinking about what another person might be thinking about what you're thinking, you can start to see how you develop a subjective experience with this. And Jeffrey Miller makes a very strong case in The Mating Mind that it was the tremendous imagination of people was probably driven by sexual selection, probably in a variety of ways. So the subjective experience would be very useful if you're imagining, like whenever I have, the few times in my life when I've ever had the guts to hit on a female, you think through what it is that you're going to say, and you think through how you're going to do it, and you imagine yourself going through that process, and then you imagine what her response is going to be. And so as you rehearse in your mind's eye what you think you're going to do, and then you observe and play it out with your understanding, with essentially a lay psychology chip of what she's going to how she's probably going to react, then you play this out, you game it out, literally, potentially, word by word, sentence by sentence, gesture by gesture, as you try to put together a performance in your mind's eye that is pleasing to an internal audience. So you see the development of these parts of the mind or the functions of mind that I talk about so often, an internal audience, something that's watching you, and the imagination of you doing things. You're essentially rehearsing for future real actions where real live stakes will be played out in real time with real live participants. So this is so Miller makes the point that thinking these kinds of things through would have, if they would make an impact on presentation that would be substantive. Let's put some numbers to it so that you can get a feel for this. Let's suppose a guy that thinks through his line that he's going to use on a female is 1% more successful, all things being equal, than a guy that doesn't. That would be very, quite substantial sexual selection. it would not be very many generations before that characteristic would dominate the gene pool. And so as a result, you can imagine that it could actually be substantially different than that. So you can see once that gets started, that a male that could easily be, all things being equal, that let's look at how females are today. So let's look at two males who are physically very similar in their attractiveness, and they're both actually quite, you know, similarly intelligent. They have similar resources. However, one of them is, you know, rehearses what it is that he's going to say, and he comes up with more charming lines that are more funny and entertaining and flirtatious. The other one is very straightforward, like John Nash out of A Beautiful Mind trying to hit on a female in a bar, just like bluntly, you know, talking about, you know, sexual intercourse with her. Now, so the, you know, he probably did, you know, if he looked like Russell Crowe, I mean, he was probably doing okay even with that blunt instrument. But you can imagine, ladies, that it would make a tremendous difference in how it is that you would say things. And, you know, we get all the way to Shakespearean sonnets and Cyrano de Bergerac. So we can see that how males have sung this song, how they have used their words, how they have essentially done the wooing process, has had a substantial impact on female sexual decision making. Now, some of that would have to do with just sheer intelligence, but not entirely. In other words, you can imagine the difference between somebody who's, quote, suave and cool. Well, what is that? Okay, well, some of that's going to have to do with an internal audience. I mean, some of it doesn't have to be. It could be a non-subjectively automaton that just happens to be slick, okay? That you could see how that could evolve. In other words, just better chops for that. But you can also see that rehearsals improve performances. As anybody that's ever been on a first date knows, okay, you know that despite how suave you might have been genetically engineered, the truth is that you're still pretty much, you're all thumbs on date one. So there's some practice and some learning processes, and therefore internal rehearsals would be useful and could be substantially useful. So if internal rehearsals could be useful, that not just for figuring out where that guy is going to come over the hill to murder your people, but also for figuring out what you're going to say to the hot girl. It's going to turn out that internal rehearsals are going to be super useful, and therefore you're going to need to have a subjective internal experience, an imagination that sees, you know, can think through and reason and feel as you imagine placing yourself under alternative circumstances than the ones that you're in right now. So so once you have that model, you can also, that very same model of moving the camera around in observation, can move the camera around and feel like you're looking right inside at yourself at any given moment and saying, what is it, what am I thinking and feeling now? And you can be an observer to that situation. So this... I think that's how, I believe that this is how consciousness evolved. And I mean, the self-consciousness that we see as humans, that it probably evolved collectively behind both sexual selection a la Miller and behind natural selection a la Wrangham. In both cases, this ability would have been useful in terms of evolution.
Fascinating. You know, I expected you to go in a different direction, but this was not that I didn't like it. It was just incredibly fascinating because I wonder if we had, you know, every strand of DNA was equal among all humans, then we would have all similar experiences. I mean, we would have identical experiences, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'd have identical experiences provided that the environment was identical.
Mm-hmm.
But the environment would never be identical.
Right. Okay.
So what we would have highly similar experiences. And we do, of course, because our DNA is extremely similar, but the individual differences in that DNA account for a large amount of the differences in the subjective experiences of humans. So that's why one person likes rock music and another person likes Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
So even they both have ears and they're both responsive to music reaching emotion centers of the brain, they're stylistically built a little bit different. And so the disagreeable extrovert is going to like the rock music better than the highly conscientious, fastidious introvert who's probably going to like, you know, Beethoven better, or Brahms anyway. Yeah, mm-hmm. Beethoven might be just busy and disagreeable. Okay. All right.
So that, yeah, because I've wondered.
Go ahead.
No, I've just wondered about, you know, the randomness. You know, if let's say you had a box, a clear box with a little mechanism to flip a coin, and it was mm-hmm. engineered such that the force of the flip on the coin was in the exact place every time, would it go through the same number of twists to get, you know, and would it always land on the certain side?
Yes, it would.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's just pure physics. So
right.
That is correct. It would. Mm-hmm. However, it would be difficult to engineer something, you know, but you could, but in principle, you could engineer something like that, very tiny variations, and suddenly we might wind up with a random process. Mm-hmm. Or not quite a random process. It might 3/4 of the time land heads. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure where this is going for you, but that's okay.
Oh yeah. I mean, I guess I was going with it in the sense that what I thought was the reason why we have those objective or subjective experiences, because we just have differences in DNA. So we're trying to spread our genes in different ways because we are different.
Oh, I'm not sure that that's what they're asking, Nate. I think what they're asking is, why would we have evolved subjective experience? So in other words, we don't believe that, you know, my cat doesn't have subjective experience. It just looks up at me and wants food. Okay. It has feelings, it has goals, but it doesn't have a self-reference thing where it's thinking, you know, my name's Annalise and what should Annalise be doing today with herself? You know, I could go over here. I could go over there. They're not having that kind of internal dialogue or self-reflection. Hmm. And so that bizarre characteristic of humans, the question would be, you know, you could simply have a super complicated organism that didn't have that. And you could, you know, for all we know, that's what a whale is or an elephant. In other words, they may not have any kind of self-reflective process like that at all, but they can have great intelligence and great, you know, great capability and sophistication inside those heads, but it wouldn't require a self-reflective kind of a process. Now, so the question is, why would that evolve? And Miller and Wrangham, and I'm sure others, you know, take a run at this. And I don't think that in typical philosophy hasn't taken a run at this in across history, because it didn't have, I mean, it might have, but it doesn't have a clue. They're not, you know, philosophers of the ages haven't been thinking like evolutionary biologists. So now we're thinking like evolutionary biologists. Why the hell would you have this system? And the answer would be, well, it must have, you know, something so sophisticated and expensive in terms of information processing capability almost certainly had to have a very strong advantage selectively. So the question is, what is that advantage? And there's two options. It could be either survival advantages or it could be reproductive advantages. And I think in the case of human self-consciousness, I think we find evidence of potential use for design on both sides of the equation. There's no question. I understand Wrangham's point completely, that you would absolutely be thinking about what the other guy was thinking about what you were thinking. In other words, so the capacity to imagine, you know, that someone else is actually thinking about what you're thinking, and then you are thinking about what you're thinking, et cetera. That whole process, you know, that would require tremendous imagination and essentially looking at yourself from the outside and then imagining different scenarios that you would do. That creates a self-referent process. And the same thing is true of Mackinac mates. Same thing. That you have to be looking at yourself as if you're an outside observer and trying to, you know, think about what different courses of action would do for you with respect to success in that arena too. So I believe that both survival and reproductive competitive pressures have led to a tremendous amount of growth of the human brain, leading to the machinery necessary to have a virtual reality program built into our neurological structure, so that you have the subjective experience that it is. That's what I think the question is that they're asking.
Fascinating. Well, in my life, I've found that even though I might originally disagree with you, Dr. Lau, you end up being right. Yep. So you have. So in this case, I understand. I was just misunderstanding. I have my own little preconceptions about this question. So
good. All good.
And now my mind started wandering on a little tangent with this, with your second answer here. Yeah. And so my question came to where, why is it that we are trying to deceive others as to our actual, those processes that are happening, where we're trying to rehearse and rehearse and rehearse. And then when push comes to shove and the actual action takes place, we say, oh no, I didn't rehearse at all. Or I didn't practice.
Right.
It's just how good my genes are.
Right. Right. That's because performances are going to be performances are fitness indicators. And so you would want it to be inferred by the judges that you didn't put any effort in, if you could get away with it. Unless you're trying to sell them on your conscientiousness about how hard you worked, at which you'll tell the boss, oh boy, did I burn the midnight oil. Here's what I have for you. And he's like, well, this isn't very much. You're like, oh boy, but it's a lot harder than you think. I really worked hard. Okay. So there's going to be a time and place where we're going to try to sell people on the conscientiousness and effort itself, but usually we're not. So usually the beauty wants to look like she didn't even try. She just gets out of bed in the morning and she just looks like that. Okay. That's the idea. And the great sportsman or the great scholar, you know, the great math genius wants to make it look like it was effortless. So, you know, one of the more eyeball rolling, disgusting things that I put up with in my life was people saying, oh yeah, I got straight A's. I didn't even study, or et cetera. It's like, really? So did I. Okay. And let me tell you something, you SOB. I was in the library till midnight and I shut the place every night. So there it is immediately obvious to me that in this, you're taking underwater basket weaving, that if you're taking for psych 101 statistics, there's no way you don't study and get an A. That is impossible. There's a logical set of operations and thought. You have to read, you have to see where your mistakes are. You have to learn a tremendous amount, integrate the information, do a great number of problems, find out where things are tricky and et cetera. Are you kidding me? They don't give A's for free. And if they do, there's only a few of them that work that way. There's no way some student in high school, you know, quote, doesn't study. If they do, it's a bozo high school and they got a bozo curriculum. I don't think so. Okay. So they're just giving everybody A's because everybody's paying $50,000 a year to be there. But if you're in a legitimate competitive situation, there are other people just as smart as you. There was people just as smart as me in my grade school, you know, and some of them smarter, and people just as smart as me and smarter in my junior high school, and God knows the university, they're all over the place. So if you're going to get very good grades, you are going to study, and you're going to study hard to get good grades. Okay. So why do people do that? Fitness indicator, showboating, impression management. That's exactly what they're doing. And now there are people who are, you know, have extraordinary gifts relative to other people, usually not intellectually that way. Nobody can do complex mathematics, quote, easily without having put in a tremendous amount of study. But there's people that can walk out on a basketball court and just jump up and dunk. Okay, they didn't do anything. Now, they can't play the game very well, but that they can do, because that's a very direct, unpracticed fitness indicator. There are women that can wake up in the morning and not wash their face, and they are extraordinarily beautiful. That's true. Okay. They don't have to, no makeup, don't even have to do their hair. Okay. Better to look like it's a mess and something exciting happened the night before. Okay. The point is that
it's starting to sound like a romance novel. Go on.
Now, so the point is that, that these are fitness indicators and they're displays and advertisements. And so, of course, there is motivation to look like it just happened naturally. Okay. And so this is probably an instinctual motivational system inside of humans to quietly rehearse. Certainly, if you're a guy trying to hit on females and you're at the upper reaches of what you're likely to be successful, then you're probably going to do some rehearsals, or else you've even done them in real time so often that now you've done it 1,000 times. So you're just using, you know, an ancient trick that you learned 4 years ago, but probably not. So probably you are thinking through the cues you pick up from the female you've got in your eyesight, and you're thinking through what it is that you could say, and you're rehearsing it in your mind's eye. And when you stroll over there, you are attempting to look like this is easy, like you are self-assured and relaxed, like there was no need to plan, okay? And this is exactly what people would like to do. They'd like to look like they just sort of display their greatness, you know, as if it emanated directly from the genetic code. And the better that you can make that sale, the greater credit to your gene quality the audience will give you. Whereas if it's evident that this is the result of tremendous excruciating effort, then the audience discounts what it is that they're observing in the display, because they realize that, hey, well, with enough effort, you know, I could have done that, so it's not that impressive. So, you know, I'm always not that impressed by these achievements where people do things like, you know, they strung together 17,400 tin cans, and then they're going to post it on the internet or get a news story about it. Like, really? Well, I could have strung together 14,000, you know, cans too. Like, that's no big deal. What's interesting is something that required remarkable talent, and then there's a motivation to act as if that came naturally. Whether, you know, to whatever extent that it did or didn't, there's some motivation to try to look like it just pours out of us like the great genes that it appears to be. So that's another reason why we evolved an internal audience to watch our efforts and watch our rehearsals and give us feedback, et cetera, in order to shape our displays so that they could be as outstanding and as natural looking as we can make them.
Dr. Lyle, do you enjoy watching magic tricks?
I actually don't. I've seen a little bit of it, but it doesn't really, that's not something that's ever like dinged my circuits. It always, always bothers me, and I'm scheming about how it took place.
you don't have that high of a mystic chip in there, huh?
No, absolutely don't. So there's no question about that. And this is a point of amusement between myself and Dr. Jen Hawk, my colleague, that although we think very similarly about many things, she's got a little mystic chip in there. And so so that little mystic chip emerges at various times at certain dates and locations and events in the world. It appears that a mystical force is intervening when in fact there's a lot of numbers and a lot of coincidences that take place, which of course there's nothing mystical at all about it, but try to convince somebody with a big chip in there, it's not so easy.
Well, apparently there's going to be a full moon in a couple of days, so, you know,
take that
for what it is.
Glad you're keeping track of that.
And here we are talking about it.
Yeah. All right. What else do we got?
Okay, dear Dr. Lyle, why were we given the intellectual capacity to overshoot our evolutionary advantages and then create inventions that cause our demise? So many inventions create a better quality of life for us, but went too far. It seems that we are regressing some of those advances, either for practical reasons or pure pleasure. Some people might find joy in the remedial basic processes by which some of our goods or foods are created. And the act of doing or creating these things by hand is inherently enjoyable, and modern technology robs us of the ability to experience not only these processes, but the human interaction that goes that used to go along with them. Modern technology also allows us to use our physical bodies less, taking away from the natural exercise we would have done to get around and get daily tasks accomplished. Sometimes the deleterious effects of modern technology are twofold in that they harm not only our bodies, but our planet. So why would our minds become so advanced to create a world where we live with and around multiple pleasure traps, thus affecting our happiness? Why do we have the capacity to do this?
Yeah, this is a swirling cauldron of thought out of somebody that has, you know, been listening to the show and putting all kinds of little pieces together, and then some big brain out there is grinding away. This is exactly the center of my concerns, you know, in life, is exactly this issue. So the pleasure trap was my statement about how human ingenuity had created a set of motivational dilemmas that are actually surprisingly have surprisingly heavy cost despite their spectacular upside. So nobody wants to go back in a world where the food is scarce, for God's sakes. However, what humans have been able to do is to not just make it scarce, but make it, you know, unbelievably cheap, and now to make it super calorie dense. So the problem of getting enough calories is, although it's not over everywhere in the world, it's over in principle. There's only going to be a few generations remain that will struggle for food. And today, apparently, even in Africa, more people die of dietary excess diseases than they do of dietary deficiencies. Now, yeah, I'm not discounting the fact that there isn't hunger in the world. There is, but the 20th century saw a revolution in human beings' relationship to food, that it went from one of scarcity and concern and anxiety, which it had always been, to suddenly, you know, the number one personal goal of people in the United States is to lose weight and figure out how to eat less. So that's this extraordinary transformation. And the pleasure trap furthermore explained that there's this enormous cost. You know, the biggest, I mean, certainly a huge cost is with your health. And then, of course, people's happiness there, which is directly related to their sexual attractiveness, which people like don't like to use that phrase and comment about it. But, you know, it is what it is. I mean, here we're thinking and talking like biologists here. So the sexual attractiveness of an organism is a very big deal. And if the sexual attractiveness is severely compromised, you can expect there's going to be psychological consequences for this. And so the pleasure trap, the rich food, drove an unprecedented epidemic of obesity and excess weight, which drove an unprecedented decline of the sexual attractiveness of a vast percentage and majority of the population, for God's sakes. And so now, you know, we scratch our heads wondering why it's so difficult to find a partner that matches up on all these dimensions, and that where people are mutually sexually attracted to each other. And you have in the middle of this an extraordinary problem with excess weight. So this is a double-edged sword is what we have. So this is the the person's question is, why did this happen? Well, it happened because it just so happens that that human beings' brains got big enough that this organism got really smart. Now, not all of them got really smart, but some of them got very smart. And as a result of that, and the fact that they've got these, you know, posable thumbs and clever little digits that can move, you know, very, very accurately, and to put together and essentially reorganize matter in a way that, you know, if you're a dolphin, you've got flippers, you know, you're not going to reorganize anything. But if you're a human being on land and you've got fingers, you can use your brain to analyze the movement of fingers and the materials that you are using, you know, those fingers on. And you could start figuring out how to essentially rearrange the universe. And as you rearrange the universe, if you're smart enough and you've got enough imagination, and you've got a communication abilities that were all evolved for different things, it turns out that you can wind up with spectacular advances. Now, they don't happen in leaps. They happen in one tiny little innovation after the next. And so 10,000 years ago, we had nothing. We had no specialized information at all. We had a spear, you know, that was it. And that same spear had been around for several, probably 100,000 years at least. So the so now what happened was that as a result of a multitude of factors coming together, you wind up with, you know, the first obviously being agriculture. And what happens, agriculture probably arose as a result of human beings being successful enough that they had colonized all over the planet in substantial enough concentrations that they were running into each other. So there probably needed to be a solution to how it is that we're going to get food without encroaching on the other guy's land, and then we're going to have a fight over it. So being forced to try to figure out how to get more calories per square foot, if that in fact is what happened, and it very likely did, what took place was agriculture. So the agriculture revolution then winds up taking place in multiple places around the globe over a few thousand years. And what happens then is that because agriculture is more calories per square foot and more calories per unit of effort, it turns out it's more efficient. So as a result, it starts to take over human activity. So hunting and gathering start to get displaced by agricultural activity. And at the increased amount of calories, not only per unit of effort, but also critically important, is per unit of land per square foot. So it turns out that agriculture on average can, even early agriculture, can produce 100 times as many calories per square foot. Because you could produce 100 calories more per square foot, you can have 100 times as many people in the same land. So now what happens is that you get high concentrations of humans in the same place, vastly higher than you ever saw under hunter-gatherers. Well, the thing is that this creature is just smart enough. So two things are happening at the same time. You have a high concentration of people in the same place where you never did before. So now you've got 1,000 people where you only used to have 25. So you've got 40 times as many humans that you're talking to. So you've just collectively vastly increased the total amount of knowledge inside the collective brain. Not only that, because it's agriculture is more efficient, not everybody has to spend their whole time getting food the way they did under hunter-gatherer situation. So now you wind up with people being able to specialize their labors in different things. So people start learning how to make moccasins. People start learning how to make a harp. And now you start to find out that human beings can transform reality in an infinite number of ways as they reshape reality to what human beings like or need or want. Now, so the person's question is, how did we evolve such spectacular abilities? The answer is, they're not that spectacular. Our abilities are not that spectacular. If you were to take 100 of the smartest people in the world right now and put them on a desert island, they couldn't build a cell phone. Not a chance. The smartest ones that there are. Okay, there's no way. They would have no chance to do so. Even 25 years old, you have you have 100 of the smartest 25-year-old engineers on Earth. You put them on a desert island right now, come back in 50 years, you don't have a cell phone. Okay? It's way too complicated. Too many little pieces, too many little parts, an accretion of knowledge, bit by bit by bit, none of it located in a single brain. It's distributed throughout a vast network of humans. So now you have collectively human beings can do unbelievable things, like completely change the relationship between human beings and their food. Okay? But it wasn't one spectacular ability sitting inside human beings as an animal. It's a collective action of little bits of expertise in millions of individuals. That's how it takes place. That's the world that you see. And it turns out because they can act cooperatively, their ability to transform the world to human ends is just staggering. Now, so what does this all mean? It means we're going to wind up with, frightening looking two-edged swords. So at some point, believe me, I would have loved to have some kind of fancy spear gun and ultimately a carbine rifle in order to shoot a wild animal that could threaten me and my family. However, what's going to happen is that's going to lead to a cultural arms race with respect to that. And then pretty soon we've got nuclear weapons, 150 years later. Unbelievable. 100 years later, probably. So again, not in one individual, but in the collective genius of coordinated action, you wind up with unbelievable things. Now, on balance, we're way better off. It's not even remotely close. But this person asked the question, isn't it interesting that some of the simple things, the simple pleasures of life, the simple efforts, i.e. growing food, cooking, working collectively with other people in essentially a village-like environment, isn't it interesting that some of these things are soothing and pleasant? Yes, it is interesting. Some of these things are fitness indicators. Some of these things are indicative of our willingness to be helpful and to be able to be cooperative in a group, and our ability to show that we're good producers for the group, and the fact that we're interacting with the food itself, and the fact that we grew it right off of our own vine, so we have this perceived self-efficacy that we could survive without modern civilization or anybody else. There's all kinds of little chips inside our head that can get tickled by simpler situations. So very few people who have ever had those tickles wind up living in a mud hut, growing their own food, talking to four people. And they don't do so because it's not that interesting. But the human being has generally great curiosity. It wants to learn more. It wants to expand its knowledge so that it can make the finest choices that it can in order to optimize its existence. And that doesn't mean foreclosing a great deal of knowledge typically. So we wind up with yin-yang balance, open is closed, modern versus traditional, questions. And this is what I call wisdom forks. And that is that, it's a process of learning of not only about humanity in general, but about ourselves specifically, about what are the kinds of balances that I like in my life. And to look out for when life and the modern opportunities take us out of balance. So some of those balances are, as this person mentions, the rat race, which is what I call the hill climbing gene, and the relentless pursuit of pseudo esteem, where it feels like this is a very energy efficient thing to do to get tremendously popular and successful and everybody see our Instagram or whatever. When the truth of the matter is that what people mostly enjoy is earning esteem in the right way from people that matter. And so also eating healthy food and feeling really good and enjoying the taste of natural food dominantly in your life, I would argue that that's a better way to live than to be self-indulgent as hell. I have to tell you, though, I know somebody that is self-indulgent as hell. And I can also tell you that's one of the happiest people that has ever lived. Okay. So I don't pretend to have a universal prescription for all individuals. But what we can have is a series of questions as we contemplate some of these alternative choices and dilemmas. And so that's what Beat Your Genes is about. And it's about recognizing that human ingenuity has collectively given rise to a phenomenal opportunity that we don't have to spend our time digging for potatoes in the dirt, only having one or two mating choices, having pregnancies inevitable from unions that are of modest interest, et cetera, and then face injury or disease as disastrous consequences, and wild animals in the cold. In other words, we don't have to do those things. So the modern environment has vastly lifted human beings into a place where their nervous systems can spend a great deal of time without those negatives. But at the same time, it has lured them into some trouble. And so that's what this whole podcast and my career is really about, is the examination of that. And so this was a great question. And in the weeks and months to come, we will continue to pick away at some of the specifics as we get questions from others, as well as when we get Dr. Hawk on here, we'll talk more directly about some of the things that we want to do to make smarter choices at these wisdom forks.
Fascinating. Well, Dr. Lau, we are looking forward to Dr. Jen Hawk coming on here, and I'm excited, and I'm just, all of our listeners are excited. So,
all right, very good, Nathan. We'll talk to you real soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.